it feels like it does this really great job of capturing that intoxicating beginning of first love. We get the all night phone calls, the sense of sort of sweet monomania and possessiveness. And yet we quickly see that this isn't going to just be that. This is a couple in their 30s who have both been in marriages before, who have kids who are entering puberty. And it's a really interesting place to be in terms of a book. Can you tell us a little bit about the couple?
Yeah. Like you said, they are in their 30s. They live in Portland, which was also a conscious choice to set the book in Portland, which I haven't really done that much before. When I write something, I usually don't talk about the location a lot. A couple of years ago, when I was working on an anthology, the Portland Noir anthology, that really sort of opened my eyes, like how great, how like special and how cool that was to like have stories that were set, you know, in the place that you live. And it really made me appreciate that kind of thing. So it was really fun for me to have some Portland references in the book and to do that as well. The couple, they are both parents. The man has a son and the woman has a daughter. I was really interested in that whole mixed family sort of element of the story as well. I have a son as well. My son's 19 now. I really enjoy hearing about people's parenting adventures or misadventures, being a parent, you know, like as your kid gets older and you hang out with other parents or talk to other parents, it's always really funny to compare notes about like what their kids are like and what they're into and stuff like that. And so that was something that I wanted to explore too, kind of like talk a little bit about the kids, you know, from the parents' perspectives, which is sometimes almost like a clueless perspective. You know, you don't really know exactly what they're thinking, but you're trying to trying to
probe. I thought you picked the perfect age for the kids too, because one of the feelings I get when I read the novel is a sense of how fragile life is, but also finding love, like how, and I think that's something you realize with accumulated experience. So you have these older people who have a lot of past haunting their current relationship, but also a sense of appreciation that who knows how long this will last. And you also have chosen children who are just at the phase when they're starting to self-individuate and push away from their parents. So even that relationship sort of feels tenuous and like it's going to change in an unpredictable way sometime very soon.
Yeah, I think like being a parent and raising a kid, it's almost that there are these kind of weird parallels with like a love affair where, you know, the kid is really, you know, your child is really enamored with you. You know, they look up to you, and, you know, that will hopefully last for a while. But usually when they get to be about 13 or 12 or whatever, you know, sometimes 16, they start to, you know, get a little bit more distant, and, you know, and that happens in relationships sometimes too, you know. You start to become a little bit more of an individual, or, you know, you kind of have these growing pains, basically, you know, whether it's a relationship or like a teenager growing up. And so that was something I was trying to capture for sure, because it's something that I think a lot of people relate to, that whole thing of being in a relationship or being in a familial relationship and feeling that, you know, somebody, you know, like distancing themselves, you know, or just trying to,
and even while the couple themselves are moving closer, distancing themselves from each other too at various moments.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I think the book, that I appreciate a lot about the book too, is that it doesn't feel like it comes with an agenda about what love is. It feels like you can be in love and you can also feel lonely, or you can be in love and be seized by fear. you can be in love and also be self-sabotaging at the same time. It's you do this great kaleidoscope around all these various ways of contradictory being, I think.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's really like love is such a such an endless sort of topic, such an endless kind of minefield. You know, it's everyone has their own idea of what the ideal love is and how to operate in a love relationship. And I tried to, you know, capture a lot of the different sort of nuances. The book is made, as you know, the book is made up of about 200 short chapters. And so,
yeah.
You know, nothing more than two pages, some of them as short as a paragraph. And I tried to, one of the things that I was trying to do is to try to capture something slightly different, some sort of new aspect or nuance or layer of this emotional state, you know, of love or being in love, or heartbreak, and to illustrate that in each one of the like 200 you know, pieces in the book. So
it does almost feel like you're flipping through a photo album of a relationship and you're looking at these little brief snapshots of moments.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intended?
Yeah. I really like being able to try to capture a scene or capture a moment in a short scene, in a paragraph or a couple of paragraphs. I think that's something that I got to practice a little bit with my own life. My previous book, The Common Pornography, the memoir, is very similar. It's a lot of really short chapters, and so in a way, it's almost like a relative of this book, like a cousin, you know.
Yeah.
That's all nonfiction, of course, and this is fiction, but I wanted this to have a similar feel, and I think it does kind of have a similar feel because of the short, you know, the short sort of vignette style, and because there is this really personal sort of tone to the book.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with Kevin Samsel, the author of This Is Between Us. So, Kevin, why don't we hear a little bit of the prose?
Okay.
Some of the vignettes.
Sure. The book is broken up into five different parts, and they each part encompasses a year in the first 5 years of the relationship. This is a one from the beginning of year two. The park down the street is our park. The old man who works in his garden three houses down is our old man. The cafe where we get pumpkin scones on Tuesday mornings is our cafe. Those scones are our scones. That song by Fleetwood Mac is our song. And so is that one by LL Cool J. I took my friend Sarah to the auto parts store on 82nd Avenue so she could get a new battery for her car. You seemed upset when I told you, but you said that nothing was wrong. Finally, before we went to bed, you said, "I can't believe you took her to our auto parts store." And this part, I have a lot of parts, or several parts anyway, where it's like a conversation. I think a lot of times things are revealed in conversations, of course, especially when you first start going out with someone and you're trying to learn about them and you're like, oh, what was your first boyfriend like? Or, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, what's your happiest memory? Things like that. So there are a lot of moments like that. I told you that I still loved all my past girlfriends. How many is that, you asked? Well, probably not all of them, I said, but five or six for sure. You turned your eyes from me and I could see your shoulders drop. I tried to explain it further. Love is fluid, I think. It doesn't follow timelines. Once it starts, it doesn't end or anything. I mean, it might stop growing, but maybe it just buries itself inside of you when a relationship ends. So like you can dig it up again if you want to. All of those exes contributed in different ways to make me who I am now. Same with you and your ex-boyfriends. If you never went out with John, you never would have learned to like cool music. I'll always appreciate that about John, you said. But can't you just be thankful? That's part of the love, I said. I always think about who will be at my bedside when I'm dying, you said. What if all my ex-boyfriends were there? I wasn't sure what to think about that. Are they nice? I finally asked. I mean, do you love them? I did, you said. But what's the point of that? The hospital room can only fit so many people. Are they all going to huddle around me and try to hold my hand? I'm claustrophobic. Besides, that's what the funeral is for. So you just want me there, I asked. You answered back quickly. I don't want anyone else to see me die. It will be our own private moment. There are a couple of parts early in the book where it kind of just quickly describes the children. My son, Vince, was droopy-eyed, sweet, a kid with soft, almost chubby edges. He wore friendship bracelets and always wanted to be useful. He hardly took naps after the age of 4. He was a tornado with Legos and remote control cars circling around him. He turned his attention later to skateboards and cop shows and European metal bands that released techno remixes. He sighed more, smiled less as he got older. His black hair was a cowlick in front and a cowlick by his right ear. He hated his hair. He was named after his mother's father, who used to like me, but doesn't anymore. It's always strange when I see my former father-in-law now and call him by that name. The tension tightening the air around us.
That second vignette around dying, where it ends with wanting to be just together, the two of them, but mm-hmm. with this wondering about whether all the ex-boyfriends would be there, that feels like that encapsulates the two meanings of the title in a way, because we have this is between us sounds like this is something private, but of course mm-hmm. in this book it's not private, it's being observed by their children. It also feels haunted by both of their pasts mm-hmm. and their fears around the other person's past, and then it's also about all the things that really is between them, the things that keep them from connecting at the same time. And that feels like an encapsulation of the book in a couple hundred words.
I guess you're right. I think there is a lot of baggage, as some people would call it, you know, and it's weird. I think some people sort of think of that stuff as being kind of a negative force in a relationship, the previous relationships and things like that. I personally don't feel like that's a bad thing. I think that I try to convey this in the way I write about the characters too, that everyone, you know, whether they have had bad relationships in the past or have made mistakes in love in the past, and that's all a part of who we are as people and who these people are as the characters in the book. And so I always think it's a little weird sometimes when people have relationships and they kind of judge the other person too much on what they did in the past, and they sort of let that bother them. I've always felt like you have to let people, you know, have their own experiences and make whatever mistakes they make, and, you know, because all of that stuff that happens in a person's past is what makes them, you know, what they are now. So I'm not a psychologist or a relation, you know, like a relationships expert. I just tried to pretend to be one while writing this book, I guess. I don't know.
Well, people, I'm sure, noticed when they were listening to you reading those vignettes that there are no names, that the male protagonist mm-hmm. is referring to his lover as you. Can you tell us about that choice and what sort of effect you were trying to achieve by doing that?
A lot of people seem to talk about that part of the book, the second person narrative, I guess you call it. But I wasn't really conscious of it being something that was different. I think when I first started writing it, I wrote it. It originally started off like I wrote like about 10 of these little things, like some of the really short paragraph sized ones. And it was just like a short story. I was like, I'm going to write like a paragraph that, you know, about this couple. I'm going to write like 12 paragraphs about this couple. And each paragraph is going to illustrate some different little thing. And it was just like a fun story to write. And so I wrote that. And I was like, oh, this, you know, actually, yeah, this was cool. I think I'm just going to keep writing more of these, you know. The way I looked at it almost was like more like the language of what poetry is or what a poem is. So like if you read a book of poems or a book of poetry, you see like you and I everywhere because the poems, for the most part, are personal. You rarely see poems. Well, maybe I shouldn't say rarely, but you don't. To me, the most effective poems are the ones that say you and I, and they're not like, you know, like John, you know, Kennedy said this, or right. You know.
What also makes it feel like a found object in a weird way too, like you're listening in on a very private conversation.
Yeah, you know, and that's I just like to have an intimate sort of personal feel to how I write. I think that's the kind of writing that I like to read, and I think if I'm writing something and I feel distant from it myself, then it's not as engaging for me to write it. So for me to write it in this you and I sort of style, then it made me feel much more like me personally was actually part of the book, you know, even though the book is fiction, or at least like most of it, or, you right. know, half of it or whatever is fiction.
But let me ask about that a little. It does feel like a companion piece to your memoir, and they both have short vignettes. Mm-hmm. One is nonfiction and one is fiction, but they both have this confessional quality to them. But in a way, the memoir, it feels like, has a little bit of a cooler tone, and this mm-hmm. has more of a warm tone. I don't know if that's your own impression yeah. of it, but that warm, sort of tender, fragile tone of the novel makes me as a reader even feel like it's more of a memoir, even though it's fiction. And I wondered yeah. if you were playing with that confusion between nonfiction and fiction intentionally, or if that was something that you just yeah. discovered in the process.
I wasn't intentionally doing that. I think it does. It could get confusing for some people who've read my previous work, not just the memoir, but I've also written, you know, essays and personal stuff that have appeared on other websites or magazines. And so a lot of the stuff that people have read from me in the past couple of years has been more nonfiction memoir stuff. So then to put out a whole book of fiction, you know, of course, it's probably going to, you know, people are going to start reading it thinking that it's, they might get confused at points like, oh yeah, I forgot that this was fiction.
Right.
I mean, obviously, when you're writing fiction, even a lot of it is based on stuff that you've experienced or that you've heard about. So, you know, there are parts of the book, obviously, that I have personal experience with, either like they're kind of close to something that I've gone through in a relationship, or you know, or that I've heard about through, you know, another relationship or something. So there's definitely a lot of real life, I think, in the novel, but I don't think I was trying to like slyly, you know, do anything to like you know, make people think that this was like a disguised memoir or
sure.
anything, because it's not a disguised memoir.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today with Kevin Samsel about his novel This Is Between Us. So I wanted to ask a question about a theme that reoccurs in the novel of voyeurism, and it feels like there's all these examples of it. Obviously we have the children, in a sense they're always watching their parents falling in love with someone other than their other parent. But we also have the remembrance of watching their own parents having sex. we have them having sex in the kitchen while watching their kids in the yard, watching ex-girlfriends from the car, watching the partner with the lights on, but then also even imagining being in a reality TV show. And this great part around heaven as voyeurism and hell as being unable to see the lives of others. So it feels like it keeps coming back, and I wasn't exactly sure what that was about. And so I wanted to hear your thoughts on it.
Those are really good observations. Something that I may have not actually, thought about as I was writing it, that there are so many, little parts about watching people or kind of I think there's the end of one chapter, it says I feel like we're just keeping an eye on each other or something like that.
Right.
And that's really interesting. I mean, I think that that whole thing about how if you go to heaven, people who believe in heaven and hell, the characters think that if you go to heaven, that just means you can kind of watch over people on earth and enjoy that, and hell is basically being locked away somewhere where you don't know where everyone else is or what they're doing. That would be a pretty good definition of hell, I think, for a lot of people, because that's one of the things that we really cherish in life, is to be able to watch other people or share moments with other people, or the people that we love around us. We want to be able to see them having experiences and growing, and we want to see these things that they do in their life, because a lot of times you can live vicariously through your love, not just with your own life and what you're doing, but if you're married and you're watching your wife and your husband succeed in what they do, then that can be just as thrilling as anything else. So, but that's a really interesting observation about the whole, the chapters about where people are kind of spying on each other and things like that.
I also wondered if it was partly a product of finding new love as an older couple, and that maybe when you're younger, you would just be totally in it without that both nostalgia and self-reflection, and that observer mind that would be wondering based on all these accumulated other experiences that you have to sort through at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think if the characters were, 20 or, in their early 20s or 18 or whatever, it would be a much different story. I think even in those kind of early romances, I think that people still have a lot of baggage, whether it's because of the growing up in their family and, depending on what their family's like and stuff like that.
That's true.
Of people can still have a lot of drama in their life, even by the time they, turn 18 or whatever. But it's definitely different, I think, for it's definitely different for adults. It's when you get into a relationship when you're in your 30s or 40s, there's a lot of history that you may want to know about, or maybe you don't want to know about.
Were there any specific books you were reading while you were writing this one that you were looking to for inspiration or clues on how you wanted to put it together? Any authors that you were trying to get infused with while you were writing?
I was reading a lot of poetry. I've kind of rediscovered poetry again recently, I almost feel like poetry has had a little bit of a resurgence in the last couple of years, in a way, especially locally. And there's a lot of great young poets that are coming up, and even some older poets that I've discovered that I really like a lot.
Could you name a handful of them for
yeah,
listeners?
I mean, I discovered Sharon Olds like a year or so ago. I work at Powell's, and so I'm often shelving books in the poetry section there, and I see the Sharon Olds books all the time, and it's right by Mary Oliver. And I just didn't really know like that much about her, but somebody read a poem of hers and I thought like, wow, that's really great. And so I started reading her stuff. She writes a lot about relationship stuff. Her stuff is actually like pretty like nitty gritty kind of intense stuff, you know, for a poet who's like now I think in her 60s or 70s maybe. There's a lot of young poets that I like a lot. Zachary Schomburg, who's a Portland poet, Dan Majors, Ben Mirov, Gregory Sherrill. There's a book of his that came out on my press, Future Tense Books. His book is called Monogamy Songs. And in a weird way, like his book is actually, it's sort of similar to my book. His is more obviously like prose poems, but they're kind of linked prose poems, and it's all about this relationship that he had a few years ago, and it's like a very turbulent relationship, very passionate but very turbulent as well. I think when I was working on my book and I was kind of like getting his book together and like helping him edit his book a little bit before publishing it, I kind of thought like, oh, this is like the kid brother version of my book, you know. It's like, because they're in their 20s, and Monogamy Songs is kind of a cousin book to
the next
to
this. To go after reading
this one. Yeah, it's really great. But there's a lot of poets that I really liked a lot. I couldn't really find books that have the same style with the short chapters and just being as far as like novels go. So I'm not sure like what else to compare it to. But like I said, I was reading a lot of poetry, and I think that was inspiring me. One of the great things I think about poetry is I like reading poetry when I'm writing something, because there's this sort of implied sense of poetry. A really good poem kind of implies something or points your brain somewhere else when you're reading it. And so that helped me sparked ideas in my head. And so I would often be reading something like a Sharon Olds book or something, and I would have my notebook and a line of hers or something like that would make me think of something. I'd be like, oh yeah, like, yeah, there's that time where, you know, we did like carve our initials in the tree, or, you know, like things like that. It's sort of like a memory trigger sometimes. That was really great to read poetry and to be influenced by that.
Well, it's great having you on Between the Covers, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
We were talking today with Portland writer Kevin Samsel, the author of This Is Between Us from Tin House Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscast. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
On Thursday, November 21st, KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a discussion on racism and settler colonialism at home and abroad, a conversation toward building global solidarity. Student speakers will explore and counter the master narratives that deny our histories and our rights, from the European conquest of the Americas and the enslavement of Africans to the ongoing colonialism of Palestine. Settler colonialism has promoted racism and obstructed the self-determination of indigenous communities. The event will take place on Thursday, November 21st at 6:30 at the Native American Student and Community Center at Portland State University.
Up next, Kate Raphael interviews Eileen Pollack about her recent article, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? And how we can encourage the young women in our lives to pursue all their dreams. Eileen Pollack was one of the first two women to receive a Bachelor of Science from Yale, graduating with honors in physics. But instead of going on to a career in the science and math she loved, she ended up teaching creative writing.
Why are there still so few women in science? That was a question posed by a New York Times article a few weeks ago. In the third paragraph, I learned that the author was one of the first two women to graduate from Yale with a Bachelor's of Science in Physics. So as I often do, I flip to the end to glance at her bio, thinking, who is this woman? Is she a professor of physics? Is she maybe a Nobel Prize winner in physics? No, to my surprise, I found that the author, Eileen Pollack, is a professor of creative writing at the University of Michigan. She is also the author of numerous novels, including Breaking and Entering and Paradise, New York. Eileen Pollack now joins me by phone. I'm really happy and excited to be talking to you because I have to say, I can't remember when more of my friends sent me an article at the same time. Everybody was talking about it. So you graduate summa cum laude from Yale, having excelled in quantum mechanics and gravitational physics, yet you don't go on in science. Why not?
Well, that's what I set out to figure out. I wasn't sure myself, which I think is part of what I've discovered, that quite a few women walk away from science courses, careers in science, without being quite sure why they're walking away. It feels shameful to want to be something, want to do something, and then not go on in it. And I think so many of us just stop and don't explore why. So actually, a few years ago when Larry Summers, then president of Harvard, was asking why there were so few women even today in the sort of top echelon of professors in physics and math at Harvard or anywhere else, I was trying to think, why did I walk away? And, you know, I really wanted